of no invasions, no catastrophic. I mean, if we say 9/11, but comparatively speaking, that's not very catastrophic compared to bombing Berlin or Dresden or the destruction on the eastern and western fronts of Europe.
Yeah.
So what we have is we have an establishment which has not changed for a long period of time. That establishment goes all the way down into the various departments to include the Department of Defense, the Central Intelligence Agency. The only new individuals who have come into those have been, for the most part, neoconservatives. The neoconservative movement is the only new group of individuals. Otherwise, you end up with the same old boy, Nat, that you've had. If you look at even the Bush family itself, it came through this various, all the way back to 1900 and beyond. There's a relationship between the industrial military complex and the Central Intelligence Agency, or whatever you want to call it, the G2, whatever it is at the time. So, yes, there is a automatic influx of people from the same group. Father having a certain mentality, the son would not be that far off. It's true. So, therefore, you see this. They have the incapacity to change. What we did in Vietnam, what we did in El Salvador, what we did in various areas of Bosnia and Kosovo, we do the same things today in Iraq. They do not change with the geographical locations. They do not change with the cultural aspects. They themselves stay with the same mentality. And their mentality is usually a mentality of support for a particular group, not based upon any type of ideological aspect, but based upon more or less pressure within the United States itself. In other words, if you get a bunch of Greeks in the United States and they have a strong lobby, then we're going to back the Greeks. If you have a large number of Iraqis, who in many instances, many people don't realize, but a large proportion of our Iraqis were Iraqi Jews. So therefore, we were going to back an invasion based upon the pressure they place on us. Again, just the Jewish lobby itself is able to control a lot of our various foreign policy. And the reasons are not bad, because by very nature of most of the families, there's an internationalism. They come from an international environment. We will see in the future, and I think we've already seen that, the Chinese have become a very important factor in our foreign policy. And overseas Chinese, who are here in the United States, they relate, especially Taiwan is a good example, to the government and are able to create foreign policy. So our foreign policy comes from within, in which these people are more or less become friends or will go to school with. El Salvador was a good example. Many of the individuals from the higher families in El Salvador went to the West Point. And that's true throughout Central America. And so therefore they have friends who are in the military who then become the attaches and the heads of military groups down in those areas. And so therefore they have this camaraderie, which has nothing to do with the objective foreign policy, but is a totally subjective friendship type situation. This is true with Bush and Saudi Arabia. So what you're seeing is, and what we always look at, we look at the top level, but that goes all the way through. That's at the bottom level. So when we say that, you know, these guys, like, they were born, almost the old boy network, was born to do what they do. And again, you find prosperity in going along with the system. You do not find prosperity by objectively looking at something, analyzing it, and going against the system. Weapons of mass destruction, I am sure, there were several probably, let's say, field-grade officers and foreign service officers of the middle rankings who were, as I would say, eliminated from the system because of their propensity to telling what they factually believed was the truth, which in reality over time became the truth. But there was no discourse, because once they stated that, they were looked upon as being outsiders and looked upon as being naysayers. And that in America, the biggest thing with America now is it doesn't want to change anything. I mean, that's the reason Barack Obama is doing so well, because the people have reached almost a point. And when you look at the masses and they've reached a point where they are so upset, then you come to the conclusion the establishment has become so intent on being certain specific way that it doesn't have any idea of what's occurring outside of its own elements, which is bad. And again, on policy, is exactly like you can do this economically, and to be truthful, most economists are just prostitutes of industry. You've never met an economist who forecast a recession until the recession occurs or it's right on it. Then they say, oh yeah, and by the way, there's going to be a recession. But all the time, they're trying to tell everybody how wonderful that it is. It's this, the American, again, has this driven factor of always being positive. To be positive is the most important thing in life. Truth doesn't mean anything. Positivity means everything. So, you know, if you can't explain it through one means, you use another means. And you can always, as I stated before, you can always find, and not only intelligence, but any information, you can always find someone somewhere to back that up and say, this is the way it is. Once you do that policy. So it's not intelligence driving policy, but it's policy driving intelligence. And then, just again, like I say, it hasn't changed at all. What is occurring right now is once the United States gets into a country, the economics take over and the government it is supporting becomes so dependent on it that all of the officials in the government lie about what's really occurring so that they can continue to gain the monies and the influence. And everyone recognizes that once a war is over, the individuals who have co-opted with the United States will probably leave and come to the United States and receive fairly beneficial positions and everything else. So you look at the Vietnamese, second generation, many more doctors today, lawyers, everything else. So it wasn't like they were really killed or destroyed by the system. The system helped them while they were there. The system helped them when it fell. So, I mean, the only individuals who really got a good deal out of this were the losers in many ways, because they came to the United States. The same thing in Iran, after the Shah fell. There are many Iranians here who are living 8 times as good as any American who had been here for 100 years or 200 years. So what I'm saying is it's almost perpetuates a method by which you're sitting there saying to the individual, well, what do you think about it? And the guy, of course, is saying, well, hell, I have nothing to worry about. I'll tell him a lie, you know. I'll say that that village has so-and-so in it. And if they destroy it, you know, what's that to me? And especially when you're in a society which is very tribal or very ethnic-oriented, like Kurd versus Arab versus Farsi, those people don't care that much about each other. And when you get to Afghanistan, it's even worse. So what you have, especially in Central Asia, You have people who literally are trying to create old scores and saying, now hit this group of this tribe. You know, they're not Baluchi. They're not from the Punjab. You know, so you know you just constantly are doing that. And the United States gets enthralled in all this, and we only see that surface.
Yeah.
We don't go deep into it. We don't teach, even at our area specialty schools, we do not teach the depth of religiosity or religion. We don't teach, I mean, if you leave and you go to Iraq, every person should have read the Quran, should be halfway knowledgeable of what it says, so that when an individual gets up to him and says something, you know whether or not that's true or not true, but be objective. Right now, we have a bunch of people who are saying, you know, the Quran says that women are no good. Well, the Quran never said anything like that. And we should be teaching our people what it does say, and then let them make their own opinion afterwards.
So give them some cultural awareness.
Absolutely, and not only cultural awareness, but if an individual is in something like... let's say revolutionary development or in psychological warfare, they should have a in-depth, at least year, of studies by individuals who live within the country, but do not bring in people who live within the country who have a subjective opinion of everything. That's another one of our promises. We usually get people to train us who are totally subjective in their views of what the relationships in the war is all about.
It's like you're saying yesterday, like, a Zionist should not be interrogating someone in Iraq.
Exactly. Or, I would go so far as to say, if you take a person who is who very strongly believes in Judaism and Zionism, he shouldn't be a station chief in Egypt. He shouldn't be a station chief in Iraq. He may be brilliant, but there is no objectivity there.
Yeah.
It's totally subjective.
Yeah.
And let's be frank, he starts with a cultural mandate by his very nature. And everybody says, oh, well, I wouldn't be that way. I'm beyond that. I'm intellectual enough to not really do that. That's not true. And the system should make sure that that doesn't happen. Because what does occur is you begin with individuals who recognize that there are certain information that's being derived and that it is incorrect, but because of their subjectivity, lets it go and lets it move on. Where they don't look at the details of it and say, hey, this just doesn't sound right. An example of that was in Egypt, where our station chief was, again, an individual who was very smart, very capable. He was Jewish. But, again, he was not able to, because the Egyptians knew he was, they would give him all types of information, which would be incorrect. I mean, because they're not completely ignorant. And what people don't understand is we have this mentality that only Americans are smart and nobody else is. And that these, because they are technologically not advanced as we are, for the most part, especially in the Muslim world, especially with Islam, because it's such an old culture and everything, they are shrewd. They have perfected the ability to distort the truth in a very, very well done way. They create a lot of gray and everything. Doing that, you never get to the real aspect of what's occurring. I think a good example of that, again, is Bin Laden. You know, when you ask him where he's at, no one knows where he is, but someone knows where he is, but they'll tell you something like, well, I don't know where he is, but I think, you know, and goes through that here. So, yes, we did the directorate made And that's another thing, because America is so aware of computers and of numbers, What we do is we have an individual who we create, there's this interval of discussion, finding out something, and then documenting it by using various methodologies and everything. And so what it comes out is a clean sheet of paper that looks real neat, and it's an Excel sheet or whatever you want. And everybody looks at it and says, oh, wow, that looks neat, and that must be what it really is. When in reality, it's just nothing.
Yes.
And that happens.
Reality is too messy for the database.
Exactly. And a data, and unfortunately, especially with when you deal with numbers, you don't really end up with anything except a quantified amount. But I mean, I would much rather go against 100 Arabs who just came out of a village than to go against Mahajideen who were 20. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there's no quality in that, qualitative aspect to that. And see, there were only economic reasons for the supporting the fascism in Vietnam, just like we did in Iraq. Well, that's true. The economic, always with the United States, almost without exception, economics, because that's our main mission in our establishment, is to create an American economic empire. Mm-hmm. We're not like the Romans, who are not trying to create a military empire. We're not trying to even look at property. Mm-hmm. We don't care about property. We don't care about trade. People always talk about trade. We just want wealth.
Yeah.
And we want control of the resources that create that wealth.
And it's not like we have a civilizing mission like the British or the French.
And, well, again, we have in ourselves created that. Mm-hmm. But to the rest of the world, they do not see us as a civilized group. We did not start off like the French and the British. We did not start off with a fairly established country, which was very homogeneous. We started off as a bunch of ruffians who killed Indians, destroyed whole indigenous groups and everything. So people who are, and especially people who are educated here in the United States or anywhere, recognize slavery, destruction of the people who lived on this continent, all indicate to them that this is not the guys, all the founding fathers, most of them were pretty good scoundrels to a great degree. So, you know, this is not like noblesse oblige. This is a group of guys who were opportunists. The guys who fought at the Alamo, they didn't fight at the Alamo because they wanted to die. They wanted to fight at the Alamo so they could get more land and get as much as they can out of the whole game. So, I mean, that's the way we are. I'm not saying that's bad. You know, understand ourselves. We better start understanding ourselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's. I think that's the biggest thing. If you understand yourself, you understand others. If you do not understand yourself, you're starting with misperceptions. Because others look at you and say, well, that's not the way I think of him like he thinks of him. Mm-hmm. So, Professor Wee agrees, asserting that America betrayed the ideals of freedom and democracy. And our fundamental rights, we American politicians have not yet changed their policy. Exactly, have not. They've no. Until something dramatic occurs, we're not going to. Mm-hmm. It's the problem of supporting personalities rather than. And there again, the personalities are based upon relationships that were founded, as we always do in the United States, in universities, are founded in relationships between people at younger ages.
Mm-hmm. People who went to the military together.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Military academy, like I say, you know, we, when I was in El Salvador, Noriega used to have a party for all of the West Pointers down in Nicaragua. And, I mean, some of the things that were done in those parties, no person outside the group would want to know about too much because it was not the greatest things that he was doing sometimes. So, you know, that's...
But Doug really wanted you to, you know, read those quotes.
Yeah, government corruption, again, government corruption was based solely on the fact that the amounts of money that were poured in, just like in Iraq. I mean, when you have tremendous amounts of billions and billions of dollars poured into an area, you automatically... corruption wanted to be in the United States here with Katrina. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, just the auditors today were saying, you know, tremendous amounts of monies were brought in. And so what does a guy do? He gets his best friend to become the head of something. He gets high salaries.
Yeah.
He then says, well, what about my buddy who was a roommate of mine? He needs a job. So that it just begets after another. We smother them with money. It's the same thing you can see in Central America. That you take a Salvadorian officer and a patron army without the corruption he brings along. I mean, yes, that's absolutely true. And consolidation, as I spoke earlier about the necessity of consolidation, which has not occurred because you have all of these various delineations, and they go directly back to Washington, or they go to higher commands, and they're not really under the control of the local person. And it really, it gives a complete, it's one of the policies of war that you don't do that. It becomes inefficient and ineffective. Yeah, there was no, just as there is in Iraq today, there's no nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
So when you sit there and talk to a person in Vietnam or something, and you were talking, he was worried more about his family.
Mm-hmm.
He was worried more about, and the family would be coming over here to the United States. He worried more about getting the gold out of Vietnam and bringing it back here to the United States and getting a good home and some type of situation where he could, for one generation, live off American money that was sent over to Vietnam. The second generation, he, by that time, had his children who were going to be educated in fairly good schools and everything, sent. Now, that's not true of everyone, but a large proportion of, especially the higher groups, did occur. There were some guys who, like Mr. Vinh, my interpreter. Mr. Vinh was... You know, he just had to get his ass out because he just had, you know, was it, and honestly, truthfully, a toady for the Americans. So they had to get him away, and he came over here, and he, you know, but then he fell under the spell of the Vietnamese mafia over here because he couldn't afford to give their the amounts of money he had borrowed from them. They came down and just blew the hell out of his shop and everything. So, I mean, you know, this lingering aspect of people coming here to the United States, and like the Russians today, the Russian mafia. I mean, again, they just transplant themselves into this country, and they create their own laws. They don't. You don't see a lot of Vietnamese going to police or anything. You don't see Russians going to police. They have created their own, and each one of these places in the United States, they created their own indigenous type of system. So we always talk about the United States as a country run by law. No, it's run by different groups of people in various things who are oligarchs, almost. And again, the event defeat in Vietnam did not repress the impulses. No, the military will never be repressed in the fact of trying to continue to... expand its ability, because that's what promotion is all about. That's, again, and not only promotion, but now it's become, which it wasn't before 1980, it didn't occur as much. But today, what has occurred is literally a person can become very, very wealthy as a military man by the nature of going from the military into some type of other, is again, a business.
Yeah.
It's really military business, and that's what you can call it, military business. Military business does it real well. And again, the same group. I mean, William Walker was a good example in El Salvador. Next time you saw him, he showed up, was in coke. Was in Bosnia and as a peace. Well, of course, he wasn't a peacemaker or anything.
Yeah.
He was an agent of the establishment, going around doing these things. I mean, I think if someone would just kind of go into the newspapers and watch where William Walker has been, it would be a quite interesting in itself, almost. Mm-hmm. Because, and of course, he's probably related in some ways to William Walker, who went down to Nicaragua in 1857 or something, and mm-hmm. took over the whole country with a band of thugs mm-hmm. and ran it. So, you know. Now, Carter was probably the only individual who understood the military, because of being a military man, and he understood but underestimated their ability to destroy a president. Mm-hmm. Carter wanted very badly to relook at the world as he has been doing today. I mean, he's that type of human. He's a very much of a humanitarian. I think he tries to create a level playing ground in many ways. He himself, being a technician, unfortunately was a micromanager. But what he didn't recognize, which is worse, was that he went against the principles of the establishment itself, both the Democratic and Republican Party, in that he was trying to rearrange some of the previous aspects that occurred, like we've always dominated Central America and everything. He wanted to kind of make it more democratized. Carter really was an individual who worked towards the principles, the old principles, I call them, pre-Reagan. Because after Reagan, there was not one president, nor has there been one administration, that has not stayed on the same track of globalization, decreasing the ability of the American worker, taking his wages and having them go down, and bullshitting him about the fact that they're better off today than they were yesterday, mm-hmm. when all statistics show they aren't. Mm-hmm. But Carter was an individual who really tried very hard to bring in the third world, to do those things. And in doing so, he made very much the military unhappy, the CIA unhappy, mm-hmm. and anyone around him. Therefore, when the Iranian episode occurred, mm-hmm. the military literally, what's the word for it? Where they put him into a position where the rescue mission mm-hmm. was, I perceive, and maybe I'm wrong, but I perceive that the generals knew the mission wasn't going to work in the first mm-hmm. place. So,
but Doug really wanted me just to get you to read those quotes in the tape recorder. Could you do that for me?
Oh yeah, surely. Oh, okay. Phoenix, let's see, Phoenix was the creation of the Old Boy Network, and they were a group of individuals who came from both the military and Central Intelligence agencies, such as Kobe, and most of those individuals were in an environment in Vietnam in which they lived very well and wished to perpetuate their lifestyles. Mm-hmm. Any policy can be found for supporting intelligence that the directorate, which we used at that time, the computers and the statistical evaluations of VCI, were by nature wrong. Anyone who had in any way died, not just VCI, getting real VCI ambushes, as explained, the Vietnamese lied to us, we had lied to the director, and the director made it into documented fact. And that was true in almost, not all instances, but in many instances. It was a war that became distorted through our ability to create fiction. Absolutely. There were only economic reasons for supporting the fascist Vietnam. Again, when fascist may be a word which is overstated, because in Vietnam, what it was it was for the most part a ruling class made up a large part of overseas Chinese.
Mm-hmm. And Catholic converts.
Absolutely. Right. Catholicism had a lot to do with the fact that if you were in the establishment, you were in the Catholic, even the bishops themselves had power.
Well, Ziem's brother was a bishop.
That's right? What I mean.
Yeah.
Right. So, and again, we did in Vietnam just like we did in Iran with the Shah and the Sabak. And it says Professor Weed, well, that's good. Let's see. Is the problem supporting personalities rather than democratic institutions? Yes, we supported specifically personalities from Key to CM, and we went through the thing, and it was mainly based on the fact that they had contact with us through various methods, from the military to the wealthy businessmen who were in the area. The Vietnamese were victims of our corruption. Yes, because we smothered them with money. And we literally came in and would supply them with almost anything that was necessary because we thought we could overwhelm the Viet Cong by doing it this way. Salvadorians, even today in Salvador, I don't know, I haven't really kept up with Salvador as much, but I don't think it's changed that dramatically. With consolidation, we could have control. Yes, if we would start regulating our own situations, both in and out in our foreign policy and within the United States, such as various representatives from foreign countries being able to associate with congressmen and everything, and looking at it from a perspective that, you know, what has happened is we believe that globalization is good, so we believe that it's good for us to deal with Chinese, or it's good for us to deal with, that a congressman can do that. And in reality, it creates a method by which these people can have an extraordinary effort on the part of our own legislative aspects, as versus our people, who can't afford it because we're all working. So what you've got is you've got a bunch of rich, either Iranians, Iraqis, Saudis. I mean, they are stronger in our foreign policy than our average Midwestern, businessman, small business. I mean, small business, comparatively speaking, has very little voice as compared to these guys who come from overseas. Only in Salvador, because of the vast reduction in the CIA's paramilitary forces instigated by the Carter administration, these officials affected their policies through proxies from allied countries. Right. Again, in El Salvador, both Taiwan and Israel were very strong in being used as individuals who supported the Salvadorian establishment and the military business groups down there.
Can we get into your time in El Salvador now?
Yeah, please.
So I was just wondering if you could just explain what your responsibilities were there as an advisor to the U.S. military group.
I had two responsibilities. One responsibility was more or less plans and programs, and I did the military assistance programs, and specifically gave the U.S. military would support the Salvadoran military with various types of logistics and everything. When Carter came in, they stopped to a great degree the amounts of arms that were coming in, and there again, the other countries were bringing them in. Likewise, we had a support for the, and one of the things that the U.S. did, and I think it's because of the fact that we learned at some point that teaching people when they're younger, such as at the military academies, you automatically get a person for life. Mm-hmm. And we barely had the capability of teaching them more or less the rules of the American mission of economics, and we did that through either English courses or stuff like that. At the same time, what was occurring was there was Salvador was just on the beginnings of the revolution itself that mm-hmm. occurred, and so there were a lot of individuals from both the left, if you want to call it the left, the National Liberation Front, who were mostly lawyers and doctors, who were middle class and were seeing the country completely decimated because of monies being shipped out of the country and put to Swiss banks and everything. Mm-hmm. And then there were, like they say 13 families, but probably 30 families mm-hmm. who controlled the total economy. And those, they were the white hands, and they controlled the paramilitary, the LaGuardia, and all of the various groups that went around literally killing anyone who raised their head in opposition to the established organization and the establishment itself. And everyone, without exception, every one member of that 30 or so families, the 13, they say 13 to 30 families, were completely behind any type of retribution or killing of peasants. They really didn't care. Mm-hmm. Plus, there was this ethnic aspect to it where, you know, most of the peasants were Indians. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the families that were there were coming. They came from Italy. They were European.
Yeah, the descendants of the Spanish elite. So,
yeah. And in many ways had relationships with Europe. Mm-hmm. And at the same, in Lebanese, well, Lebanese too. So this group was literally taking monies and just shipping it out. Because they knew something was coming and they did not want to be there. Amazing with the business class is that the business class will always move its monies before something occurs. They usually pretty much stretch their capital out throughout various areas of the world. They've learned that through what has occurred, so that they never leave it within the country itself. And then the United States has to come in and kind of, in most instances, keep the money up by paying it to the dollar and putting in more money. So it's always a socioeconomic crisis that occurs. And when a socioeconomic crisis occurs, they'll move the money somewhere else. And that's what you'll see once you start seeing monies being drawn off. Like the United States, you can't say that because it's what it comes in. But once you start seeing monies drawn off of a country, you know something's going to be occurring. Mm-hmm. And so they're pretty strong there. But anyway, what my position was to deal with both the attaché, the deputy director of the embassy, which was a political officer, with the individual who, for any other reason, would say he was the station chief, caste chief. And then, unusually enough, in this instance, the military advisory group commander, who had particular credentials, having worked for the Central Intelligence Agency.
So you were in El Salvador in the immediate aftermath of the Carter administration's reduction in CIA paramilitary forces.
Right.
And then,
I was there when he did that.
So how did that affect what was going on, and like, what did the CIA do?
Well, it's, at the higher levels of government, it seems that they became, as I say, these various groups, such as the Chinese, the Taiwanese came in, and they started running, they had an officer who was a liaison for the military academy. There were larger numbers of Israeli. Its presence became well known. The military, by its nature, here's a good example, tried to continue to create a constant message that Cuba was trying to take over El Salvador. And by doing that, we would fulfill the obligations of trying to stem this supposed infiltration of Cuban agents and everything by bringing in special forces groups, teaching, having them teach. So what El Salvador did was it just became a, again, various commands and agencies poured in without any overall coordinations, different aspects to try to quote stem this. With Carter in a position, most of the foreign service establishment as well as the military establishment were very pro conservative military industrial complex types. So therefore they were totally against Carter's, although Carter put out the edict to do these things, it was always stymied by both our military and our foreign service, because the people who were down there, and the Agency for International Development, because the people down there were very, very much against it. The Chamber of Commerce was more important than anything that, you know, was. And since many of the owners of the fincas and the businesses in El Salvador were part of the establishment here in the States, and in, especially, like I say, various families from Florida and even Northeast, these were international families. They had a lot of influence directly on the embassy and on our foreign policy there. Much more in many respects than the bureaucracy coming down. So, I mean, and it was stopped. Carter didn't even have a chance. I mean, it was like he was completely, it was almost like his naivety was beyond comprehension.
So he bit off more than he could chew?
He not only bit off more than he chewed, but he literally created an animosity between the administration and all of his functioning agencies, such as the Foreign Service, the military, the CIA, every one of them. They were almost all not happy with what was occurring. Because all of them came, let's admit it, most of them came from about the same type of environment.
So, were there any CIA personalities you remembered from Vietnam and El Salvador? Were they implementing anything like Phoenix? And did you have any moments just like deja vu, just, I've done this before, or I've seen this before?
Well, yeah. I mean, most of the, it wasn't called Phoenix, it wasn't called anything, but the same, without exception, the same various programs were redeveloped and sent into El Salvador. Later on, when I went into the Middle East, the same various programs were set up. So, and like I say, the United States is not great for change. I mean, you could go through, if I walked in right now into Iraq today, I don't know if they would call it Phoenix or what the hell, they would call it some other
actually code. Actually, Phantom Phoenix.
Phantom Phoenix, that's a good one. I like that, Phantom Phoenix. That's, again, would be, you would see almost organizations change, a little personalities change, but basic mission, very, very limited to what we did in Vietnam, beginning. The military, especially the military high command and the military advanced schools, try very hard to create new innovative ideas. They had the Delta Force, they called it, which, you know, they tried to create it. But for the most part, what's so funny about it, military people are, by their nature, they're not innovative. That's not the reason they got in the military in the first place. And especially the guy who succeeds in the military. He by his nature, is not what one would be looking for if you were trying to create some type of change. He's not a change agent. He's a conservative by nature, almost.
Are, you know, intelligence people change agents? Is the CIA, what is the system?
There are some individuals, but overwhelmingly now, what has occurred is an air of people being afraid of losing their jobs. They don't say directly anything. They know they can be replaced very easily, and so therefore what you have now is more or less the top doing whatever, and then having the intelligence fill in. And for the most part, let's say there are old intelligence officers, there are bold intelligence officers, there are no old and bold intelligence officers.
So, you know, in your previous interview with Doug, you said that you formed friendships with some Salvadorian officers, and you know, sponsored a study group, and you talked about land reform and things like that. And what led you to this, and how did it play out?
Well, I was teaching at the military academy, plus I lived outside the city at Zacatecla, and to be very frank, the Salvadorians were the first to kind of initiate with me. I was not a linguist. Most of the individuals who came down to Salvador were reservists, and individuals who were more or less out of the mainstream of the military. I was a regular army officer. So the Salvadorians did lean towards me in the professional sense. Although I was not good in languages, they accepted the fact that I was more or less like them, as versus the individuals, and especially we had Puerto Ricans and we had Mexicans, and the Salvadorians did not consider either Puerto Rican or Mexican to be of any type of intelligent capabilities to some degree. They considered it to be almost inferior. So they did not, and it was almost an ethnic situation where they didn't consider these individuals to be really true Norte Americanas. You know, they were guys who were put there because of their language and really nothing else. So, especially the LaGuardia and their intelligence officers, probably for various reasons, Justo Pastor Bonilla, who was head of their signal intelligence, got to know each other quite well, and on a familiar with the wives and everything. Most of these individuals were much more educated than their American counterpart. Many of them went to Sorbonne, went to technical schools in Europe. Went to our command and general staff colleges, were very, very well educated, and, you know, they had, like, the head, it was a major who was head of their whole oil and gas industry down there. So what they did was now his brother was also head of the LaGuardia. So you can see there was, again, this family's connections. There's all these family connections and everything. And in doing so, once you got in with one and he liked you a lot, you could get into, you know, the whole system. Mm. Now, on the other end, I had some friends who were from the university who were, again, meeting them socially and everything, who were really part of the Liberation Front. And in doing so, I kind of, I never could figure out why, but I got into the middle of a situation where I might have a guy over from the National Liberation Front one night, and the next night I'd have the guy who was the LaGuardia chief, you know, which was interesting but scary because I was not a linguist. I didn't know what exactly was occurring around me. I was in a swell, and things were happening, and I had no idea what the hell is happening. By happenstance, though, the military, as Carter stayed on his path, got mad at our inability to supply them, and so most of the mill group were kind of ostracized. And in the end, as I left, they were giving out these swords to the guys who left from the military academy and from the military staff. They didn't give it to any of us. But as I was on the tarmac, a Jeep drove up, and it was SKS for the National Liberation Front. And they gave that to me. So there was a feeling, I think, among, let's say, the pro-Liberation Front group that I was trying, at least to some degree, not unlike when I was in Vietnam with the Phoenix, trying to be at least objective and not trying to hurt anyone, or not trying to create a situation which would, you know, kill a lot of people. There was no mis- and that's one thing I have to say about President Carter. I don't think he in any way wanted to create. It was Reagan, once he got in, who began this concept of everybody's a communist, everybody's bad. I mean, the judgmental aspect. I can say the United States literally changed with the election of Ronald Reagan. It has not deviated since. It is on the same mission as it was the day he walked in. When he walked in with some of the most kooky military intelligence advisors there were. Unfortunately, one of them was Henry Kissinger, who was noted as being an intellectual and very capable. No one ever looked at him as being the guy who created the Vietnam War and lost it for us. But and did several other things around the world, in which every moment and every time he did something, if you look back at history, it was a disaster. No one ever says, it's a little like Einstein. What Einstein did do and what myth says he's done are two different worlds. And I equate Einstein and Kissinger a lot. They had great publicists. But the reality of it, if you really look at it and really research it, is that, you know, they were nothing compared to what they had created in the minds of people. So I think in many ways what we did with, like I say, with Reagan especially, was that he created this industrial, and he counted tremendously on these people. Because Reagan in himself, and I don't know if it's because of his Alzheimer's or what, but he wasn't that capable at any moment in time. I don't think if a person looked at his profile and everything would say, this is the guy who was, you know, near genius or anything. Now, Carter, on the other hand, was very, very highly intelligent. He was, hey! Get away, little one. Go on. Sweetheart?
What?
Could you get Twitter? She's goofing around outside. So anyway, next. let me see this, Major Roberto Abassan, a former member of the NCO who transferred its files to general staff ideas, were used to compile blacklist operating out of Guatemala. It was a white hands. That's what he was. He was a quote nationalist, but in reality, all he was an agent of the
30 families.
Yes, the 30 families, 13 to 30 families. You can say that. The Americans, we went in, and you know, people knew that we were supporting the 30 families. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a fairly, and the reformist office of state is a successful but short-lived coup, as a result of which the Salvador National Security Agency, which had been formed by, that's what happened. With the in 79, and of course, like I say, the whole basis of Salvador was a little bitty country. It had a great population. In all honesty, some of the most hardworking and intelligent people, comparatively speaking, for a very third world, underdeveloped nation, you could find some unbelievably capable people, and the reason is because the competition was so great on a day-to-day basis because of the tremendous populations in such a small area. Most of what occurred in El Salvador was really brought about by people in Washington looking down on El Salvador. It was not an internal aspect as much as it was external. A tremendous amount of people here in Louisiana looked at Nicaragua and at El Salvador as being not so much, they were troublesome. They were worried that they would become other Cubans, sort of like. And it wasn't that they were in any way a threat. It was just that they wanted to have their own people in charge of them. And then, usually enough, Louisiana is a good example of a tremendous interrelationship between the families of El Salvador and Louisiana, their sister states. And of course, Louisiana coming from a southern heritage and background, a very authoritative in itself. Louisiana is a very oligarchical state, and they somehow relate to oligarchical states down in Central America. So, I mean, it's really amazing to me. But Louisiana and El Salvador are the same. Let's see. Now, I don't know about Department 5 so much. At this time, according to Salvadoran Army Officer Ricardo Castro, death squad supervision passed to Department 5, which is possible. Castro, a West Point graduate with a master's degree in engineering, that is a good example right there of what I was speaking about earlier. And then by the CIA Department 5, Castro explained, became the political intelligence apparatus within the general staff, although it was designated as an investigative, not an operating agency. It had a large paramilitary force of people dressed in civilian clothes because it targeted civilians. Right. And it's, you know, it's the white hands. And that was, again, an interlocking between the finca owners and the wealthy in the military, because the military, you have to, once you go into the military academy in El Salvador, you have to have a mentor. And the mentor has to be, like our senators and congressmen to get to West Point, well, this mentor will get you in. And from that time on, you're directly, it's a patron type of culture. So even if you're a colonel of the LaGuardia, you still have a patron. Who is outside, who's your guy, who kind of tells you, you know, like he'll walk in with a scar and say, now don't you think we should kill this group of people because they haven't been doing too well on my finca or something like that? And you do it. In March 1981, Castro himself began leading death squad operations using a modus operandi perfected in Vietnam, right? Yeah, that was another thing that when I was at the military camp, I did teach a few aspects of the tactics that we used in Vietnam and some of those things. Plus, a lot of the officers were quite interested, and they would have little study groups, mm-hmm. and we'd sit around talking about how the Phoenix operations in Vietnam worked and mm-hmm. everything.
So what kind of tactics was this like?
Well, again, what we did was we, police operations mainly, that the military is never good in police operations because specific targeting mm-hmm. is not one of the military's best mm-hmm. methods. That takes a tremendous amount of effort. Police operations themselves, people always think, such as tailing people, mm-hmm. such as moving into a safe house. Mm-hmm. They look on the outside as being very easy, mm-hmm. but there has a tremendous amount of coordination has to be done mm-hmm. before. Because if something happens bad, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to know exactly the time. You have to be very specialized and perfected in those type of operations if you really are targeting people. Even if you are going into the aspect of assassination, mm-hmm. you have to have tremendous prior planning. There isn't, you don't just have a guy like they show in the movies. I go out and I put up my rifle and everything. I mean, this takes technology, sometimes direction finding. It takes all type of various methods that you have to utilize pre going into an operation.
Mm-hmm. It's just much more subtle than
absolutely
the enemy unit.
Right, they show on TV where the soldiers come in and they knock down the door, mm-hmm. but that doesn't do anything except mm-hmm. piss off a mother who's mm-hmm. cooking dinner or something. The guy's already escaped. Mm. You have to know where that guy is. You have to watch him. You have to watch everything about him, what he does, when he goes to the bathroom, because people do go to the bathroom at a specific time.
Yeah.
People eat at a specific time. You have to know a lot of these various things. And you have to train your people mm-hmm. to have, be like a guy coming in and he's going to check the gas. Well, you can find out a lot about a place by checking the gas. Another guy comes in and says he's picking up the garbage. Mm-hmm. You have to do it. These are different little things that you have to. You can't switch the garbage driver. Mm-hmm. Switch the garbage driver, and the guy will, for whatever reason, because we're animalistic to some degree, mm-hmm. we'll walk out front and we'll see a guy who we didn't see before. Mm-hmm. We'll know that there's not that same guy. Mm-hmm. So these, you know, there's a lot of little techniques that are. And there are, you know, you could get a lot of this stuff, too, could be given through Panama mm-hmm. and through correspondence courses mm-hmm. that the Special Forces had, and there was a lot of correspondence courses, which you could get the pamphlets and everything mm-hmm. at the embassy and then, you know, start your classes or whatever you want to do. That's right, Norman Casperetti, you eliminate everyone. Man. That's something that, you know, it's a little like a lot of these places. These guys don't give a rat's about who is in the way. Once it happens, it's everything. Mm-hmm. So they are, again, these people do not have a concept that the people that they're dealing with are almost human. Mm-hmm. It's rather sad. Mm-hmm. We use that word fascist military so much. I don't know. I don't know. You know, fascism in itself connotes a group who are thugs, I guess. I don't know how to explain fascism, because fascism is a specific.
When I think fascism, I think the merger of state and private business. I mean, that's.
If that's what it is, that's what it is. Yeah. You're right. If that's what you're, you know, I would, you know, in one of these things, I try to explain that to mm-hmm. people, because a lot of people have various
definitions.
Yeah. There's different, unfortunately.
I also think it's kind of like some kind of suicidal impulse to fascism.
It is. You're right. And it's the same, and a zeal to accomplish anything at any cost. Mm. That's, you know, it's, and that's the reason why in these countries you have LaGuardia. Mm-hmm. The LaGuardia was taught by the Spanish LaGuardia. Mm-hmm. And these guys, man, when they go in, they clean up. Mm-hmm. There's no feelings. There's no empathy. Okay, let's see.
So is there, like, anything about your time in El Salvador that you would like to highlight? Anything, and specifically about any interactions with the Central Intelligence Agency that you had there?
Well, again, I think when we talk about the Central Intelligence Agency, we continue to discuss it as just an organizational aspect. Mm-hmm. The Central Intelligence Agency is really, it's like the country team in El Salvador. Mm-hmm. The country team in El Salvador was a group which encompassed all. A very small area of that was the CIA. Mm-hmm. Probably in El Salvador, especially all military governments that were in Latin America, were much more pronouncedly towards the military groups. Mm-hmm. And unusually enough, we always talk about intelligence officers. Mm-hmm. Well, especially in Central, there were FBI officers, there were CIA officers, there were military officers. Then there were officers who were literally friends of other officers in other countries. Mm-hmm. And they are as much part of this dynamic aspect. You know, it's a general officer down in Panama who has a lot of friends who are in these various countries and everything has as much to do with the foreign policy and where these countries go as does any chief station chief in Central America. Mm-hmm. So I don't want us to get, you know, mixed up with the process by saying this is a group that is really different or something. Mm-hmm. They're not. Yeah, they all run the same. It's like, I guess you'd say like a good example would be McCain. Mm-hmm. He's an example of a naval officer probably, I don't know if he was ever in the intelligence area, but who had tremendous influences on different things. Mm-hmm. And his perceptions of things were brought from his grandfather's father, who were both admirals. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what he may now be in charge of all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And the fact remains that he has a certain mentality that what he was brought up with, which to me at least indicates, as I watched him the other night, a very, very hierarchical type of established group that wants little and nothing to change. Mm-hmm. And both he and his wife are sitting there, and he espouses that. So, I mean, he could be as much, even much more, 100 times more, than any one particular person anywhere else in the world. So, you know, what's so funny is we don't understand that about a lot of times the legislation and how it goes. Mm-hmm. When you get to Washington, it does not become particularized, it becomes generalized. Mm-hmm. So a congressman like Woody Jenkins is running. You know, he was a guy who sent these dolls down to Nicaragua and blew, you know, had all type of bad news trips as a very conservative advocate backing the Contras in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. He's running for Congress right now. Mm-hmm. Jenkins was had some radio, very wealthy guy, at least he was. But again, he was in that. When he was governor of Arkansas, supposedly somewhat of a Clinton, you know, MENA. You know, he didn't fight any wars, but he gave up a lot of stuff to help them. I watched even Blanco right now. I mean, a lot of these things have a lot to do with internal aspects. The reason why Blanco sent more than normal, the amount of people who are the Louisiana National Guard to Iraq was so she could keep her unemployment numbers down. So there's all types of these variables that occur.
All these pressures.
Yeah, yeah, and it's you know, and if right now they came down, like I say, here, you know, we sit there and we talk about El Salvador, but you were down in New Orleans. You saw the damage there, and you knew that this that black water was in there, and you knew that they had at least had several deaths that no one knows where they are or anything. Yeah. So what I'm saying is, you know, if they can do that in this country,
what can they do abroad?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, you can talk to anybody. You know it. Everybody else in New Orleans knows what happened. Who did they protect down there? Was it the middle class out anything? No, it was that round Tulane in the Garden District.
The Isle of Tonight.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, it's really obvious. I think it's so obvious that probably that's the reason why the working class right now are so up in arms.
That's why no one votes.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Because hell, whatever you do, and I'll be frank, I at my age right now, I look at it and I've become almost to the point of saying, whatever happens, it's going to happen. It's just going to keep going because there's nothing to stop it. There's no, I just don't see a, and we always talk about the United States and the threat from India and China. Hell, those aren't threats. Those are countries that have billions of people. They have to survive and take care of themselves. The threat really comes again from a united Europe, with probably a tremendous influence from this, the previous Soviet Union, Russia now. And that is going to be in the next 50 years or 60 years, that's where our threat's going to come from. Because they have the abilities to become a threat. There's nowhere, there's not one person that ever went over to China, and I went over to China, that will not come back and say, oh God, along the coast, there's no question about it, it's growing leaps and bounds. But the fact that you get in the hinterland, it's
the 19th century.
Exactly, in the 18th century.
Yeah.
And the same thing with India. So therefore, you know, those to me are just not even remotely threats. And the only other threat is, of course, globalization. Because we're sitting around, like you and I are talking about the old world of nationalism. And we don't have that. We're not a nation. We're a conglomerate run by corporations for corporations and for economic profit. For families, which are probably less than, you know, half a million or so. So, you know, so when I sit around and say, well, there's a 4 million person country down in El Salvador, and there's 30 families. Look at 380 million people and how many families. It's not that much difference. So,
yeah, the proportions.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's just, you know, it doesn't hold water.
So returning to your military career, I guess sitting now, you know, after like reflecting on it for years and looking at what's happening in the war on terror and homeland security, you know, is there anything that you would just like to say to, you know, the general audience of this audiobook? Is there anything that...
Well, I think there's several things. As I said, I think there was in all situations, there's a time when things can go down two roads. Probably the election of Ronald Reagan was the beginning of that time, where the United States literally has gone from a national direction to a total global aspect. This was not done out of just an evolutionary process. This was directed and created by groups of people who wish to do this. I don't know, and I'm not sure. Everything in me says that this was not, nor is, the best way to go. And I think that, as we've seen in many of these instances, as we look back on them, we're going to look back on this where we did certain things, especially in creating the inability of discourse between superiors and subordinates. Mm-hmm. And I think giving much more authority to various intelligence organizations than they should get. We need much more oversight. Mm-hmm. I think, looking back on it, I think, in all honesty, I think that what you have is you have now created, which has been, but was at least to some degree squashed, is unbridled self-aggrandizement, especially among the higher ranks of both the intelligence, the foreign service, and the military. Mm-hmm. And at the cost that they are worried more about their personal advancement than they are in any way for the good of the country. Mm-hmm. And I get that back to another paradigm that occurred with Reagan, is this concept of greed is good, mm-hmm. and the fact that our educational establishments were created to support the professors in their living standards, mm-hmm. as versus trying to distribute education and knowledge. And I think that has hurt us tremendously. And then I think, in all honesty, the baby boomers who have come into positions of power during this 20 years, mm-hmm. for the most part were brought up on television and are very third rate in their abilities to manage and to capably compete against individuals in, let's say, Europe, and even in some respects, Asia, mm-hmm. their counterparts. Mm-hmm. They are not as educated. They are not as disposed towards the overall populations, mm-hmm. and having, which I think is a very important thing, is having this credo of belief in a nation. Mm-hmm. We don't have that. Mm-hmm. We seem to now have a belief in how wealthy can I get, mm-hmm. and how well can I live. Mm-hmm. And we espouse that, and we put it throughout our culture, and we teach it to our young kids. Mm-hmm. We don't teach our young kids. It's better to be middle class and have values than to be rich and go around and do anything you want. We seem to have lost that significance. And then the last thing, I think, is our ability to change. Mm-hmm. We haven't changed anything. And the reason is because we really do not have the ability to change, because if someone tries to do something, it is better to do nothing, you will succeed, as versus doing something and being wrong. Mm-hmm. The system just does not create that ability to, the ability for failure. Mm-hmm. You know.
I guess very directly is, do you see elements of the Phoenix program in the War on Terror?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, I see the Phoenix is almost a parallel to the War on Terror in that these are two programs that were created out of a rather nebulous beginning. Mm-hmm. Both the Phoenix saying that you really knew who the BCI infrastructure was, mm-hmm. and maybe you're going to go out and destroy it, not unlike Al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. and going out and destroying it, when you would start with, what the hell is it? Mm-hmm. You know, who is it? Mm-hmm. It's almost illusionary. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, what you do is you create a process to say anyone who doesn't believe the way I do is the enemy, and therefore we should eliminate him, and therefore everybody can be eliminated at any moment in time, supposedly because of just being. You don't even have to, you don't even have to have done anything in action. You just have to be.
You have to fit the profile.
That's all you have to do. You, I mean, you don't even have to fit the profile. Because the profile is so broad. Like, if you right now, and I was sitting here, and you said, I really don't think that it looks real nice out today, and I think, well, my God, he's a pessimist. Then, to me, you fit the profile of a pessimist. And a pessimist is one who does not believe in the optimistic aspects of my nation. Because if you don't believe it looks good today, then you would be, you can transmit that to something else.
Yeah.
And pretty soon what you've got is you can do that to anybody. So, I mean, plus, you can go into anyone's home today. You've got laws that are set up to be able to completely create a police state. I mean, Homeland Security, thousands of people are involved in what? And then what is going to be the end result of that? You know, I, one of the things that people don't understand is there's backlash. When you hurt other people, they're going to hurt you. Well, if you create organizations to hurt other people, then you're creating more and
you're
more towards the resentment that's going to occur
throughout
the world. Since we're a global nation and we can be hurt anywhere else, we're very indefensible. And in time, we're going to be hit. But every time we get hit, if somebody sits around and says, oh my God, you just got hit, let's destroy Pakistan. Let's next time destroy Kazakhstan. Well, you can go there forever. And of course, there are people out there who would love that, because they make money off that. So when you say, yeah, there's a Phoenix program like the War on Terror, of course it is. It's the same people running it. It's the same mentality. It's the same psychological warfare that's being played by for Americans, because that's what we did with America in Vietnam. We would set people and say, oh my God, you see, and they see some little skinny little guy and say, he's the enemy, he's the worst thing that you've ever seen in your life. And you have a bunch of southern boys who go over there who are not educated, didn't even get through high school, they go in and say, God, that chink, I hate him, shoot him. They did those things. Well, the same thing, if you take and talk about, to ask some of these kids that were over with the National Guard over in Iraq, they did the same thing, kill a family or something. At first, they... they say, well, they're just, you know, they're just goddamn Muslims. They're a bunch of bad breath people. And then they start dreaming. And then pretty soon, you've got a real problem on your hand because you've got a crazy son of a bitch running around, very pissed off at the world because of what he had to do. So, yeah, it's, I have no question about it that the establishment has created its war on terrorism just like it created the Phoenix program. And I think, in many respects, it's going to continue to do that. That's my feeling, is this is not the beginning. This is Iraq is just the beginning. Whether Hillary, Obama, whoever comes in, it's going to be Iran next.
Institutional inertia.
Exactly. It's going to happen. And then after Iran, then you're going to have... other groups, China is going to be fighting on the side. Russia will be supplying. We'll be putting troops in. Then there'll be a blow up somewhere in Central Asia. It's just going to continue to happen.
Africa maybe coming to battle.
To be truthful, Africa, the only thing that Africa, because unfortunately for the Africans, there's not a hell of a lot there to really be got. Except for natural resources. And the natural resources can be got by literally corruption itself, by getting whoever's in charge and paying him off. So Africa is not as much. But yeah, there'll be always wars. Kenya, there's going to always be those type of wars in Africa. But I mean, the real challenge is going to come when both Russia and China begin to feel that the United States is at a point where they can literally drain it. Mm-hmm. And they're bringing it in more and more into Central Asia. And that's what every power wants to see if you're on the opposite pole.
Yeah.
Bring a man guy into Central Asia and he will expend his treasury and his people. Exactly.
It's for the British Empire.
Every one of them.
Yeah. The Russians.
And there again, my God, you ought know it, I know it, you ask any professor, you ask any historian, and yet we have a bunch of people, that's what I'm saying, we never change.
Yeah.
We have ignorance at the most highest level, or if it isn't ignorance, it's an agenda mm-hmm. for a country other than the United States. Mm-hmm. And those countries, of course, that are other than the United States, which have tremendous amounts of need to have this chaos occur, is the British in some ways, the Israelis in some ways, and probably even in some ways Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, you got to look at the agenda. Also, always follow who gets something out of something. Mm-hmm. If you sit and you see something occurring, don't sit there and say, well, it just occurred. Someone somewhere has been able to benefit. Mm-hmm. If you take that back to the guy who benefits most, that guy is the guy who began the situation. Because that's...
Yeah, very simply, who profits.
Exactly. And you can figure out who profits. Mm-hmm. And what I love about America is people can knock us off saying, well, we're really not profiting. We're really against this. And so we say, oh, well, then they're not the ones. Well, of course they would say that. Mm-hmm. The question is, do you analyze and figure that out that that's not what really occurred? Mm. So that's what I'm saying. You have to kind of be a little more deep in your analysis. Mm.
So you said that the same people who ran Phoenix are running the war on terror. Can you think of...
Well, let me say this. It wouldn't be the same people because the people who ran Phoenix are a lot older. They're old guys now. They're guys who are sitting around their fireplace or sitting out somewhere. What these are is the same mentality, the same group. When I speak of, when I was in the intelligence, there were individuals, I guess you could break it up into about three groups. You had individuals who were totally crazy. Mm-hmm. And what I mean crazy is they felt that they should kill everyone in the world to get to some goal that they weren't even sure about.
So is that just like the pathology of power?
Yeah, and whether we like it or not, there's people who are drawn to that. Mm-hmm. Then there are people who I call pseudo-intellectuals. Those are guys who try to kind of rationalize everything and look at it and accept the fact that there is a necessity to do some things and at the same time be more moderate mm-hmm. in what you do. And then there's the others who are reactionaries, mm-hmm. who just say, hell, whatever these guys do, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. So you've got those guys, and each one of them in themselves have some bad points. Probably only the moderates have good points. Mm-hmm. So on both sides of this is, that's another thing you have to do is weigh. Mm-hmm. And... what I'm saying is that mentality because of the schooling. Because again, our schools haven't changed. Mm-hmm. Our training hasn't changed. So therefore, the guy who goes through this stuff is the same guy who went through that stuff back in 1972. Now, because of changes, the paradigms that have changed in the meantime over the 20 years, mm-hmm. There's been more technology. I'll be very frank. Probably not as well trained because of the number of people that they had to put through. Mm-hmm. So what you're seeing today is people probably less educated, less trained, but having those type of mentalities. Mm-hmm. And so it's the war on terrorism is And I think today the war on terrorism has created a much larger number of people who are, because of the population changes that have occurred. There's a guy who's sitting there, and he's sitting there, and he's thinking, my agenda is not for the United States. My agenda is for something else, either my money, for power, whatever it is. The guy on the other side there is looking at it a different way. So you have these guys who, there's no coherent, mm-hmm. where I believe that probably before Reagan came in, there was a much greater coherency. Everybody who went to Vietnam kind of understood a mission. Mm-hmm. A guy who is right now a Russian who just came over to the United States, mm-hmm. his mission isn't the same as a guy who comes from Kentucky, mm-hmm. and whose family have been in the coal mines for the last five generations. Mm-hmm. They're totally different. Mm-hmm. So there has been dramatic changes. But the guy who's the analyst at the top mm-hmm. has also changed in the fact that there's a guy who's sitting there who says, well, my family owns stock in somewhere, and I want to make sure that's okay. Or I come from Japanese descent, mm-hmm. or I come from Chinese descent, or I come from Indian descent, or I come from Jewish descent. Mm-hmm. All of those people are there now at much greater numbers. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, none of them have the same viewpoint on the world. There isn't a paradigm mm-hmm. for each one of these guys. And we have a bunch of people who are Islam, mm-hmm. Islamic. So, I mean, every one of those think differently. And they are vying against each other within the organization itself mm-hmm. that is vying against the world. Mm-hmm. Because we are a heterogeneous nation. Mm-hmm. And when you are that, you do not get consensus. Mm-hmm. If I was in the German intelligence today, I probably could, what I'm saying, I'd go to the guy with mouth the same thing across the street, mm-hmm. wherever, mm-hmm. because we'd all be the same. We'd all think more or less the same. Mm-hmm. If I was in, not British intelligence anymore, it's like us. Mm-hmm. But if I was probably to a great degree in French intelligence, it would mm-hmm. be that. If I was in Russian intelligence today, we'd all mouth the same. So the homogeneous nations, if I was in the Chinese intelligence mm-hmm. service, we'd all mouth the same. The Japanese intelligence service, we'd mouth the same. But the American, the Brazilian, mm-hmm. American and Brazilian and British, what else? It's about the three, those are about the three main ones. Mm-hmm. They don't think. They don't think as a nation or a people or a culture. They think as individuals mm. because they're not. Mm. I mean, I wish I could say that I'm exactly like the guy across the golf course. For me, he was black and lived in a little bitty house and, is doing drugs or something, but he's not. Where usually, and even the black officer, mm-hmm. either intelligence or military, doesn't really socially stay with me that much. Mm-hmm. We say they do, but they don't. Mm-hmm. The Chinese officer, who comes from a Chinese background, he usually tries to go with other Chinese people when they have dinners and dances and everything. The Indian, for the most part, he might go every so often, but not. He would rather be with his own people. Mm-hmm. So every one of these groups are quite different than, what we used to have. We used to have an organization in which every person in it had to have the relationship will go back almost to the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. That, everybody, so that everybody kind of thought like the same. All of them went to private colleges. I mean, their profiles were set up so that they would be private universities, family, long-term family relations all the way back for five or six generations, because then they knew what each other were thinking almost. But they, that is not possible. Mm-hmm. So
I have, I guess, two more questions, then I was wondering if you just want to look at some of the other quotes we're using and maybe...
Yeah, fine.
Okay, so I guess the first question was, like, the name of the book is CIA Speaks. And I guess, is there anything in your experience, you know, any story or even any understanding of yours that that you can share that could explain what you think makes the CIA unique or doesn't?
Well, see, that's the thing. My personal opinion is the CIA is a coordinating, or at least should be a coordinating agency, which brings together all of the various intelligence organizations into creating probably like the National Intelligence Estimate. And what the main goal of the Central Intelligence Agency, as at least I viewed it, was more or less separated, and it didn't, because it, like I say, it was much harder to deal with economics and politics than it is with the military. But the Central Intelligence Agency should be more or less a separate entity which deals with operations which are other than pure military. Now, like the war on terrorism, I now, in looking at it, we have taken down the delineation. One of the reasons why we had these various intelligence organizations and these various groups was because of posse comitatus, and because we did not want the military to get its hands too deep into the police and political aspects. Well, unfortunately today, the military has got its hands into those areas. So there is really, if you start looking at it in today's world, there's a redundancy here. Either we should separate the military back again to its original role as being a tactical and to some degree strategic element, which feeds into the National Intelligence Estimate and into the National Security, I mean National, not Security Agency, because NSA is another, I mean, you know, that's the reason I don't like CIA Speaks, because there's an organization probably much more funded than everything is. Of course, an organization which we don't talk about too much. And so, what I'm saying is, CIA is supposed to be kind of like the front guy for everybody else. You know, if I wanted to really look at who's really great in human intelligence, I'd look at the Navy in some ways. I mean, you know, they're very small, and yet naval intelligence is just absolutely staffed with some of the finest people in the world.
That's the oldest U.S. intelligence agency.
Yeah, and it's really, and it's not only that, but it's really good. I mean, it's small, and they use effectively. You know, when an organization gets too big, it starts eating itself almost.
Yeah.
And I hate to say that, but some of it, I think, probably between the Homeland Security, the FBI, the CIA. If I was going to name that book, I'd just say Intelligence Speaks.
Yeah.
Because intelligence is a group of people who are all placed together. The guy who is the signal intelligence guy at a listening post somewhere in Adak, Alaska, is as important to the whole thing as, let's say, some guy who's sitting at the embassy who's a cast, who goes to parties, and that's all he does is get drunk and ends up an alcoholic. I mean, you know, so I don't know. I think that we, you know, when you start defining things, you really don't get a true picture of what it is. It's like we always talked about the KGB. We always talked about MIs in Britain. The fact is that the GRU, after the wall went down and everything, we found out that the operations of the GRU, or the Russian military intelligence, were a lot more profound than the KGB ever was, because they had the right to kill, mm-hmm. where the KGB did not have that right because they were afraid that it would become too politically strong in some ways. So they gave it to some other arm. Mm. And that's the same thing with British intelligence service. That's the reason they call it MI, military intelligence. They don't. Now there are MI groups like MI6, mm-hmm. which are covert operations, which are really run more by the damn British foreign commonwealth. Mm-hmm. But still, it's under the guise of MI. Mm-hmm. And that's why with Central Intelligence Agency, there is so many different groups that go different ways and are personally probably, as you and I are talking, there are some groups that are so highly classified mm-hmm. that, you know, people know about them but have no idea their abilities and yeah. capabilities. So, you know, I would just, you know, if you want to say like human intelligence speaks, or, because I noticed that most of the stuff y'all are talking about is mostly human intelligence mm-hmm. versus anything else. And human intelligence in the United States is probably less than 20%, 15%. So, I mean, it's not like it's the largest factor. Mm. And so, yeah.
But doesn't everyone say human intelligence is the most important aspect of intelligence?
Woo, I don't think you Stanford, known as the CIA chief, who the Admiral, Stanfield Turner.
Yeah.
When he came in, he for sure the hell didn't think so because yeah. it was the night of the long knives and he took out probably, you know, yeah. 70% of the human intelligence. It depends on the individuals. And to be very frank with you, if you want to get down to it, the most important factor in intelligence is the analyst. Mm. So weapons of mass destruction would indicate that very, very strongly, you know. Yeah. It's not your collection means, it's how the guy analyzes that or what it is. So.
You can have all the information in the world.
And right. You could go down. And again, it's a little like economics. Intelligence is an art. It is not a science. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, when you get into the realm of intelligence, what you're looking at is the most important thing is what is a person's, what do you think they're going to do? Not what they're doing, but what do you think they're going to do? If you can get a handle on what they're going to do or what they're not going to do, then you're okay. Mm-hmm. But what we do is we go, and again, we look at things and try to stereotype them. Like, if this is covered by this, like this, and it's like that, what's underneath there? Is it a gun? Or is it a television? Or is it a ray gun? Or what? You know, that's what you have to kind of come up with in intelligence. Mm-hmm. You don't know what's underneath there, but you are then taking your best guesstimate. Mm-hmm. And of course, your best guesstimate is usually 90% of the time, depending on how you think about it, mm-hmm. is either going to be right or wrong. If you're an objective, non-judgmental person, after taking everything, you can say, I don't know what's under there, mm-hmm. which is a great answer. Mm-hmm. And then the next answer is, if I don't know what's under there, the chances are because of these, there was a train that came in here, or there's something else that came in, it could be either a manure pile, or it could be an atomic weapon. Mm-hmm. But I don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. Then you try to get maybe, in some ways, an ability to say, well, let's hear something there, mm-hmm. or let's talk to somebody who's been there, or something like that. But that's the way it has to build up. Mm-hmm. It's not, you can't put it in a computer and redo it and everything, and then you know what it is. Mm-hmm. That's what we think you can do.
Yeah, you can.
But you can see what happens when we think that way.
You can just manage your way to right. the technical answer.
It was like, when I was in England, I think this was one of the most important things that I ever learned, was there was a guy by the name of Major George Hartman, ex-White Russian Army, who was sitting at a conference with a bunch of individuals from Washington, in which the individual said, you know, we have all this technology and we have all this ability, and there were all these Americans, and there were probably about 30 of them. There was only about three of us on the British side, and the Americans always hated me because they thought that I was really an American who was a turncoat. I was like Benedict Arnold, because I was with the Brits. And I, unfortunately, even after being there for maybe a year and a half or so, I became, they never thought I was British, they thought I was a Rhodesian, because I my accent kind of changed to a point where it was more, I guess, like a Rhodesian. It wasn't as hard as an Australian, and it wasn't like a Canadian with the who's. But, and the general officers and the high officials in the various organizations just hated my guts, because they literally felt that I was betraying the United States of America, even though I was sent there and seconded to the British Intelligence Service. Mm. But anyway, Hartman was in this room. Of course, the British have a great idea. What they would used to do with the Americans, first of all, they would put the Americans in a room where all of the British intelligence officers would come in wearing this kind of wool coat and everything. Mm-hmm. They never, ever dry cleaned them. Mm-hmm. It was the worst smell in the world, and they had perspiration. Mm-hmm. They never cleaned it. And you would sit in that room with these three or four British intelligence officers, and you'd be American, and by the time 30 minutes passed, whatever that Brit told you, so you could get out of that room and breathe fresh air, you would say yeah to. Yeah, that's a great idea. And the Brits knew that. Mm-hmm. And that's how they used it. And they were able literally to go up with ideas that they had very little information about, but were able to take the whole DIA, CIA, everybody in the United States, and change it to what way they wanted to, just based on that one thing. Now, the other thing was, old Hartman was sitting there one day, and the Americans said, well, we have all this information, and we know about this area out in Siberia, and it could be a missile base, or it could be a tank. Mm-hmm. And Hartman says, I don't think so. He said, I've looked at it and everything, and I think it's just an infantry unit out in inner Mongolia or something like that. And they said, well, look, we have much more information than you do. We have much more technology. We have many more people, everything else. He said, well, let's test which one of us is the best. And so the Americans said, how can we do that? He said, we'll send in, we have sent in somebody, and we know that the third latrine in the barracks, barracks B, is broken. And the Americans said, you what? He said, we know that the third latrine in barracks B is broken because we have the ability to get that information. So the Americans said, well, how will we find out? And he said, well, you said you had as good as we did, so you find us out. So the Americans went in, and they tried all type of ways, overhead, everything they get. Mm-hmm. They ended up by sending in one of the attachés and had him persona non grata just to get in there. And then after he got in there, he asked to go to the bathroom in this place. And he went in there, and he tried to click down the urinal, and it didn't work. So the Americans came back and said, my God, they said, you must have fantastic intelligence. And could you, you know, give us any, well, no, we can't. This is, you know, under national rules that we can't do it. Then the Americans leave, and someone said, well, how did you know that, Major Hartman? And Hartman says, well, when I was with the White Russian Army, I was in that place, mm-hmm. and that latrine didn't work. And he said, and being a good Russian, I knew that the Russians never would fix that damn latrine. Mm. And that's exactly what it's all about. You know, it's background, knowledge, capability. And in all honesty, that's not what we've got. Mm. You know, we just don't have that type of... Now, Maybe we've got more than I know about, but I looking at some of the things. And who we do have, as I say, are mostly very subjective people. Mm. Hartman was not subjective because he went from Russia to England and was living a hell of a lot better in England than he was in Russia. So, you know, he felt that, you know, the British had been pretty good to him.
Sounds like psychological profiling then plays a part then, to like know what, how people think and what they're going to do.
Psychological profiling would be probably one of the most important areas that we should be doing more and more in the intelligence. Likewise, in our technical intelligence, we have the abilities now to really go into an area, and if we really want to know about different individuals, we could honestly do various medical procedures of knowing, you know, like they pee, what their urine counts are, and various potassium and everything like that, and that has been done. I mean, De Gaulle himself was known for what his disease was by, again, groups doing it who were not in the Central Intelligence Agency, who were in a different group completely. So what I'm saying is, these groups are all, so if I would say anything to Doug, is maybe just intelligence speaking, you know, and leave off that central, because by the nature of central, we're trying to create something which in many ways has over the time changed with DIA coming in more and more, with NSA, now the
reorganization of national intelligence.
Right. That reorganization completely changed everything. Mm-hmm. So I also think that y'all should look at that one, at the reorganization of national intelligence, and the need, you know, the coordination effort, and then these various operations and sections of the intelligence system.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess the last question is, I guess, something you've been talking about a little bit the whole time, but and I think of it as more of as the dilemma of American power for, like, you know, the foreseeable future. America's going to be the most powerful country on the planet.
Right.
The question is, you know, what to do with that. Like, the CIA is not going to go away. The DOD is not going away. Or our massive military is not going away.
Right.
But, I mean, what to do with that? And it almost seems now that those institutions are leading the country instead of the country leading them.
Well, that's absolutely true. They are. And I don't, you know, it's a little like every empire, except probably the British Empire in many respects. Although, the British Empire is very unusual in the fact that it never did go through that total system, because we put so many people out. But we also have, like, I think there's, 70 or 370 different stations throughout the world that we're in almost every country and everything.
Mm-hmm. You talking about CIA stations now?
Oh, well, this is all stations. This is various stations from the military to CIA to everything.
Yeah,
maybe
to
more
State
than
Department.
That. Yeah. And there's much more than that. There must be over 500. But what I'm saying is, I think what we need to do is to re-look at our technology, but based upon our lack of ability to utilize our technology, we have to start looking at the human factor in analysis, and a more clear method of being able to reach conclusions based upon objectivity than merely taking management in a subjective form and utilizing it. Mm-hmm. As I say, if you have an individual who is from India and he is trying to indicate the Indian-Pakistan relationship, one should be very circumspect and should at least have third-party verification than to accept that human being's method. And that's true anywhere.
because he's a partisan.
Exactly, and that's what I'm saying. You've got to try to create as strong and objective viewpoint as possible, which, of course, we haven't done with either Iraq or Iran. Mm. In both instances, we have predispositions for both of them. One of them were pissed off because the guy tried to assassinate the president's dad, and the other one were pissed off because they overran our buddy.
Yeah.
It was the Shah. And that was quite interesting. We've got to have a clearer picture of what really is occurring within the organizations that we're supporting. Mm-hmm. In other words, like the Sabak. Mm-hmm. When the Shah left and went supposedly to Panama, the American intelligence services didn't know where he ended up. He ended up in supposedly Egypt. Mm-hmm. But was he in Egypt or was he not in Egypt? No one really knows. Mm-hmm. They have a mausoleum in Egypt that says this is where the Shah was. Mm-hmm. And probably a year or two later, the Shah died. But we don't know exactly when the Shah died. Mm-hmm. All we have is a detail of someone saying that without total verification by some third-party source. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is, we've got to really recognize that in many instances, the individuals who are dealing with something could in themselves be as strongly disposed of trying to misinform as to inform. Mm-hmm. And that's where you have to have this kind of redundancy. And if you want to spend money, spend it on redundancy as versus spending it on individuals who, again, might misinform you. Mm-hmm. And then using our, we don't have client states. Mm-hmm. Let us stop calling them client states. The countries of Israel and probably now China, mm-hmm, run us as much as we run them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Their ability to influence us is just as much as our ability to influence them.
Well, it's kind of like a double agent, the way that a double agent is playing both sides.
Exactly. And it is both sides.
Yeah.
When I was, I think one of the things that I got, one of the most unhappy moments of my life was when I had my little bowler at Brawley, and I was in MI3, and I was sitting there at the con, and the British, of course, have a somewhat sordid sense of humor. But a British, an Israeli intelligence major came in, mm-hmm, of course dressed in civilian clothes and everything, and they introduced him around and introduced him to me, and I didn't say where I was from or anything, I just said good afternoon, and I sat down and started working again. So he was sitting across with the British colonel, and the British colonel said, well, what do you think about the Americans and them, the tanks you captured and everything. He said, well, I wouldn't give it one of those tanks to those Americans. They're just a bunch of assholes. They, you know, all they do is they give you money, you know, but they're not professional or anything like that. And he sat there and he was just haranguing the United States. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought to myself, well, who in the hell is this individual who would be able to do that and say these type of things to the British, you know? And so after he ended up, he said, now, you know, we can make a deal with you. We can get you a T-62 to break apart and everything if you guys want it and everything. Because we've always been kind of, you know, y'all helped us in our independence and all of this good stuff. So, you know, the Brits were sitting there. They were kind of smiling, knowing that I was listening to all of this stuff. So I got up and I walked over and I said, Major, I said, I want to let you know something. I said, Americans are probably very naive and in many instances very ignorant, but I said, they're everywhere, and I'm one of them. Mm-hmm. And then I just walked away. But then when I walked up and reported this to my station chief, and he sent it back to Washington, it came back saying, this is an ally of the United States, and it is not to anyone's benefit to pass this on any further than what you have, and to please forget it. Mm-hmm. Because there was someone in the intelligence agency of the United States at the highest levels who was that pro-Israeli, mm-hmm, that he didn't want anyone to know that the Israelis were going around bad-mouthing us. Mm. And this is not just true with that, it was true with the UK, like I say, when they sold arms to the Hanoi government. Mm-hmm. You know, if you reported back some of the things, the Americans really, in many ways, didn't want to know that. Mm-hmm. Because that, again, would destroy the special relationship. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know. When you become a world empire, I don't know how you play it. Mm. And who's on first and who's on second. Mm.
And where it begins and where it ends.
Right. And then the other question is, where does the middle class really fit in all of this? Because, unfortunately, that's what I am. Mm-hmm. And where do we go? And if I look at it through history, what happens to us is we are doomed to self-annihilation. Mm. Unlike the kulaks, or like the Roman middle farmers that were taxed into non-existence and into slavery almost. So, you know, it's really frightening. And even if you got out and yelled and screamed and did anything, it wouldn't matter. They'd just take you away as a crazy. Mm. But no one really...
I mean, they'll push you in a free speech zone and the media won't cover it.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. So, you know, and that's the reason I don't see where anything really is accomplished and comes to fruition. The horses were really let out of the barn in 1980, and I'm not sure they'll ever be put back in. Mm-hmm. Whoever becomes president, whatever situation occurs, it may be that, let's say, Obama becomes president. All it'll be is a retrograde movement for 4 years, exactly like Carter, and they'll do something, some scandal, or shoot him, or do something, but he'll be gone. Mm-hmm.
And the economy will tank, and then we'll like it.
Exactly, and then they will get then they can use the Homeland Security to kind of quote take care of those individuals who have created this situation, and they can always find somebody who created this situation. Mm. So that's what I'm saying. I just don't see a good outlook out there. It's kind of sad in many ways.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of funny because if you look at a lot of times films kind of pattern reality. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen a sci-fi movie of the future that everything's real nice and beautiful and there's beautiful little pastures and people running through it? That didn't happen. So
no. I mean, it's more like Blade Runner.
Exactly, and that you know, I don't know, and that's the reason why I say the intelligence is run by policymakers who create policy, and then the intelligence fills in the gaps. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we'll ever create a cadre of men and women under the circumstances that we have today that would have enough values and enough moral ethics to change that too much. And I personally think, how's your dad? Your father? How old is your father?
Oh, my dad? He's 55.
Yeah. Well, see, I get back to the thing. There's a group of people out there that was just like this. They were big, and they went through it like going through a boa constrictor. And those individuals were never educated. They were peer pressured and taught by each other. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, they don't look at historical significance and everything. And that group of people are the ones who have led us like these last 20 years, even with an old FUD like Reagan. Mm-hmm. The real group was down below where that baby booming group. And then with Clinton more and more, and then George Bush, and the other George Bush. So, you know, it's there's a mentality which is very self-oriented, and it is not community-oriented. If you go to Germany today and you talk to a bunch of Germans, you will soon feel a factor that the individual is important, but not as important as the total community. Anyway, you won't find that here.
No.
You know, and I don't know if that's a good or bad side, but I mean, individualism going to its extreme can hurt you just as bad as anything else.
As communitarianism.
Yeah, exactly. Enemy of the state. You know, you don't want either one. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I think we've gone to the one side in many instances throughout history. We've seen the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well.